Good afternoon. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. It is the afternoon of Tuesday, April the 23rd, 2024. And my guest today is Darren Coleman, who is a financial planner, wealth manager, advocate of common sense, and I think lives common sense from a financial point of view. So this should be a great discussion. Got all kinds of things that have been going on lately, I think, to get his perspective on. But I think I want to punt it over to him to introduce himself more properly. Darren?
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on your podcast. I appreciate being here. So yeah, I'm a wealth manager. We run a practice within Raymond James, one of the largest in North America, called Portage Wealth. Portage being a word most Canadians know because we have a large cross-border practice. That's kind of our specialty, working with people of money and family on both sides of the border. And that's how you and I know each other, because you're also an expert in that space.
Well, exactly. And, you know, things are tough if you're dealing with one country, but they are much tougher if you're dealing with more than one. I tend to think of it as, you know, one country, one degree of difficulty, two countries will square that, 4 degrees of difficulty. Yeah. Can you imagine if you had somebody with tax residency in 3 countries?
Oh, we have some people like that. Oh, well, you know, a friend of mine from Newfoundland, John, has a great word. He says, when it's complicated, it's tangly. So we love tangly. You love complicated. I love complicated. Our clients have complicated. We seem to be pretty good with that stuff. So you're right. Domestic only Canada, domestic only US is one thing. We love orders of magnitude of more complexity.
A completely different world. Although I personally hate it. It's just something that, you know, I've had to deal with people for years. But
you hate it, but you love it. Come on. You're good.
Well, I think about it a lot. I mean, at this point, it's hard to imagine life without these complications. And this is why, you know, when we were doing a podcast earlier, I introduced the phrase simplicity is virtue. You know, if you can get there, you're doing very, very well.
That's true. We try to get there, but our clients' lives are complicated and the rules keep getting more complicated. So even if you stand still, things change around you.
Yeah, I think a lot of the truth is they love complexity. I think a lot of them actually do. You know,
it gives some of them do. But the reality, but if you move or you're born in the U.S., you move to Canada, like you've got complexity no matter what you do. So whether you seek it or it seeks you, you have it.
So last week, as happens from time to time in Canada.
Interestingly, neither you or I are over this yet. We're both struggling emotionally with what they did in the budget, right? But we're going to talk about it.
It's part of our, it's mutual therapy.
It's exactly, we get through this by sharing. Yes, exactly.
Exactly. The trauma, figure
yeah.
it out.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I have come to expect from this government basically a total disrespect for most everybody, unless they're an assured voter or whatever. But this is interesting because really the focus was on a tax increase. Would you call it a retroactive tax increase?
I would. And it's interesting, John. I feel like at the beginning of this, I should ask you to point to your tax return and show me where it hurt you. But definitely it is. I think it is a retroactive tax increase. And the sense that the big thing that we're going to talk about is the change to capital gains taxation and this thing called the inclusion rate, which for people that may not know this, with capital gains, if you earn a dollar of capital gains at the moment, only half of it is reportable on your tax return. So the first 50% is tax-free. The government is changing that to say, well, no, 50%, we don't like that. We're going to now make 2/3 of it taxable. So that's a pretty substantial change in the rate. And what it basically means is approximately a 9 to 10% increase in the overall tax rate, depending on which province you're in.
Just to sort of explain where I think you're getting to, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the top tax rate's slightly above 50%, but if we keep it simple at 50%, so it was a 50% inclusion rate, they go to 2/3. Is it 2/3? 66%?
It's going to 2/3, exactly.
So that's like 66%. So that's an extra 23.
Right.
It's an extra 16 or whatever. An income at a 50% rate, that would be about 8,000, right? But a little higher.
Yeah.
A little
right.
higher.
So, rate yeah. And again, it depends on which province you're in, but if we kind of average it out, it's roughly a 9% increase in the overall tax rate that you're going to pay. So that can be substantial, right? So if you had $100,000 capital gain, you might be paying another $9,000 in taxes. So it can be a lot. Someone is probably going to check my math, maybe did it wrong, but at the end of the day, it's a significant increase. And what's also challenging about it is For personal taxation, it doesn't kick in unless you have more than $250,000 in that year of gain. So that's only going to happen if you sell a property or something like that. But for corporations and trusts, it kicks in at $1. There is no threshold. So anyone who has money in a corporation is going to be paying that higher capital gains tax rate instantaneously once this goes through in June. So they've also given people till June to figure out if they want to sell their property or sell their asset at the existing rules, because the new rules kick in at the end of June. So the reason, I'm going to go back to your question, which is, or your comment about how it's retroactive. And I would argue that it is for most people, because the gains that they've accrued have been on properties and things that they purchased years ago, which is why they've got that gain. So for many people, they perceive this as really difficult because they made their financial decisions a long time ago, and now the government is coming along and saying, hey, we want a bigger chunk than what we took. And for people now, it's interesting, in social media, people are saying, well, you know, if you have these gains, you're rich, you should pay the tax and we don't need sympathy for you. That may not be a fair assessment, but that's what part of the sentiment is. And I would say, you know, if you went back to people that have a pension, so whether it's a government employee or a teacher or something like that, that has had a pension they contributed to for a long time, imagine if you went to that audience and said, you know what, we're going to take an extra 10% of your pension from you. We're just going to clip it. You got 90% now of what you thought you had. The hue and cry from that audience would be just enormous. They would think that is an unthinkable, unconscionable act. And yet here we have people that have accumulated capital. Either they bought a cottage, they bought a rental property, or they, like the doctors, for example, they set aside money inside of a corporation for their retirement. They're going to see roughly 9% of that disappear in additional taxation. And to them, they're like, this is really not fair, considering the government hasn't exactly been, I would argue, you know, careful stewards of the money they've been given. So maybe instead of tax increases, you could have found a way to tighten the purse a little bit. So that's kind of the where things are right now. And our clients are obviously affected by it, because we have many people that have been responsible and good stewards of their own capital and their own finances, and they've got gains in their portfolios, or gains that they hope to have in their portfolios, and they would like to have a fairly steady state tax set of rules to plan around. And to see this significant of a change is really damaging to those plans.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a lot. Let's unpack this a little bit. Yeah. Okay.
I'm all about the value, John. I gave you a lot right there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But let's unpack it a little bit to get even more value out of that. Okay. So let's start with the whole, you know, retroactive bit. I mean, you make the point that, you know, if pensioners saw an increase in their pension payments, there'd be outrage. But at least that would be on a going forward basis. They wouldn't be stretching backwards. And the problem here is that the gains they're now taxing at a higher rate certainly have accrued over the years before the change in the tax rate. So that's what you mean by retroactive, right?
Yeah. And part of the problem with that is that a big chunk of a lot of those gains are just inflation. So, you know, if someone's taxing income, for example, well, you went to work, you made money, you pay tax on that. That's current. But if I bought a property 30 years ago or 20 years ago, and it's grown in value, and you're going to tax me on that value, well, part of that was just inflation. Like a dollar in 1985 or 1995 is not worth a dollar today. So some of what that tax is, the person may say, look, I actually never even made a positive return on the thing. It's just the value of the dollar went down. So I've got a gain on paper, but my net return might have been negative, but I still have a gain just because of inflation.
That is entirely possible. And yeah. You know, in the Toronto area, on many other places too, I mean, we've been living with a real estate market where the gains are perhaps more than inflation.
But that's very true.
You know, generally for real estate historically, right? I mean, real estate tends to track inflation.
Exactly, okay? Right.
Generally. Yep. So, you know, most of these gains, other than the strangeness of the last while, right, have not been gains at all. I mean, it's just been a question.
Exactly. You know, just been time value of money.
House now. So really, that's not even a tax on income. That is actually, in fact, a pure wealth confiscation, isn't it? They're taking part of your house.
Yep, that's a fair way to assess that, I would think.
Well, any other real way to assess it, I think that's...
Well, that's the thing. It's like they just take what was the dollar value when you bought it, what's the dollar value today? The fact that they don't look at what's the parity or the purchasing value of that dollar, that's not relevant. You know, and I would argue, and if for people to think about this, if they don't do this math in their head, just think about, what did your first car cost you, or the first job you had in high school? What did you get paid an hour? And Matt, you wouldn't work for that today, because, you know, minimum wage maybe when you were a kid was $3 an hour. Now it's 17. That's just inflation, right? And if you really want to know what inflation looks like, just go buy a sandwich at the airport. You'll see what the future is going to look like. Because those prices are definitely from 2032.
Yeah, no question about that. So we've got two problems here, right? So we have, first of all, that many times, in many instances, a tax on capital gains is not a tax on any form of income. It's essentially an asset confiscation because it's just taking part of the increase in value, which is nothing more than inflation.
In many cases, it is. The other problem is it's a tax on risk taking. And, you know, if you want more of something, lower the tax on it. If you want, you know, less of something, tax it. And we've already seen, you know, a number of measures recently about how our productivity as a nation is falling behind the United States, our closest neighbor. And that leads to lower living standards long term. So that's a problem. We've also seen the degree to which public sector employment has been growing, but not nearly as fast as so public sector, I should say, growth has been incredible. Private sector job growth has been much less, but the entrepreneurship growth has been flatlined for a decade. We haven't seen people want to go into the risk-taking business of owning a small business. And that, unfortunately, also reduces our wealth as a country, because small business is the engine of growth for any economy. And small businesses, if they're successful, become bigger businesses. So to not see growth in the entrepreneurship class is a problem. So to see an additional tax rate on corporations, that's a problem, I believe, because you're going to just get less people wanting to do it. And we're also seeing net business investment declining in the last 10 years in Canada. Businesses aren't investing at the rate that they used to. And we've also watched global investors vote with their feet. Net foreign investment in Canada is negative. More money's leaving than coming. These are problems.
People are leaving.
People are leaving too, the brain drain. And it's interesting. People are saying, well, you know, are people going to stay in Canada? Are they really going to leave because of this? I'd argue, yes. The very first email I got the morning after the budget was from someone who is a dual citizen saying, what is it going to take for me to leave Canada? How do I do that? So that was the first email I had, because a lot of people have choices. They have other citizenship, or they can get a visa. They can take a golden visa. There's nomad visas. It's not that hard anymore if you want to move to a different jurisdiction to be able to do it. And I would argue COVID accelerated that, because all of us are using these kind of technologies to talk to each other, and you could be anywhere, right?
I think that's right. I mean, for a lot of people, it's not so much that you can be anywhere. You always could. It's just that it's now clear to people that you can be anywhere.
Yeah. It's a lot easier if you work on a laptop. Where do you want to be? And you and I help people navigate that choice pretty regularly, right? So I think, unfortunately, we're not giving people as many compelling reasons to stay and invest. We're giving them reasons to maybe not do that. And someone's got to pay the bills here.
Yeah. So even before this, the problem, this capital gains increase, I think, is a problem. But it's not like before this, it wasn't a problem. Okay. True. I mean, it clearly is a problem because, you know, my feeling on this is that there are a lot of people who are paying over 60% of their income in taxes in Canada.
Well, interestingly that you mentioned that, the Fraser Institute, I just saw this report today that calculated that for Canadians earning between $50,000 to $60,000 a year. So this is not the Westons and the Irvings, right? So if you're earning between $50,000 and $60,000 a year in Canada, your marginal tax rate, when you also consider loss of government benefits, is over 50%. So if you earn between $50,000 and $60,000 a year, the next dollar of income you earn is going to cost you roughly 50 cents, because between the additional tax you pay plus other government benefits you may lose as a result of earning that dollar, that's a pretty high tax rate. And to me, that's shocking that at such a relatively modest level of income, people will be experiencing tax rates that you would think would be reserved for the wealthiest Canadians. And actually, that's another thing we should correct, is this concept of, you know, the rich are not paying their fair share. That has become, I think it's just total nonsense for anyone that actually looks at the mathematics of it. It's a good rallying cry for politicians, but it's not accurate.
Well, you know, along with the budget, I believe that the finance minister made some sort of a statement that, well, you know, this will affect corporations and the wealthy.
Yeah.
She didn't, well, she didn't, the evidence, everybody in Canada was wealthy.
Well, the idea when they went to look at some of the mathematics of this, they go to StatsCan, they go to some other measurements. And unfortunately, you know, it's a very skewed representation, because not everyone reports a capital gain every year. So that's one issue. You only report the capital gain when you sell the asset. And a lot of Canadians are going to discover, hey, I'm now stuck with this higher bill because we sold the property that we've had in the family for 30 or 40 or 20 years. So that's a surprise. So that doesn't show up when they look at who's had capital gains so far. The other problem with this is that you're also now going to bring in people that have capital gains inside their corporations, which they don't measure until they know, until the person realizes it. So this, the number of people that are going to get included in this are far larger than the government is telling us.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, just given the number of people generally, but especially professionals who use Canadian-controlled private corporations, yeah, you know, for, you know, they're really personal pensions, right?
I mean, they absolutely are. Yeah. So many, and it's interesting, the doctors in particular, I'll use them as an example. You know, they were in Ontario, you know, they negotiated with the province to generate, you know, they wanted a higher fee rate and they were said, well, how about instead of that, we'll let you guys incorporate and you'll get a tax advantage. Instead of more money, we'll let you save tax. So they did. So now their argument is, wait a second, the provincial government gave us something that the federal government is now taking away, you know, more than a decade later. This seems wildly unfair to us. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of pushback from whether it's the medical, the doctor community, it's from people in innovation, from the wealth management industry. A lot of people are not pleased about this. Now, it may not result in any change, but it's certainly from a planning perspective, something everyone who's been saving for them, for their own retirement, for their own family's benefit, is going to have to consider, what does this mean for me? And the first thing they're going to have to do is do I need to make any changes to my plan between now and the end of June when the new rules come into play?
All right, or to put it another way, should you realize the gain now and arguably, but not necessarily, get an 8 or 9% return on that?
Yes.
Or should you wait? And I think it's obviously, well, I think in any case, maybe I spoke too soon, obviously, but I think it's very dependent on personal circumstances.
100% it is.
What would be an example of somebody who really should take the gain now?
So if somebody has got a fairly large number of gains in their portfolio and it's in a corporate account for sure, they may want to look at this going, look, if I pay the money now or later, I may as well pay it now under the current rules. Because on dollar one in June, I'm going to pay more tax, period. Now, we are hearing some people taking the view that, hey, there will be a cavalry coming because I'm pretty certain in the next, you know, 12, 18, 24 months, there's going to be an election and there's going to be a change of government. And maybe the new guys, if they get in, they'll change. I don't know if I'd be banking on that because my argument is politicians are kind of addicted to tax revenue. Doesn't matter the sign of the lawn sign, the color of it, doesn't matter. They're all addicted. So I don't know if a new government will actually repeal any of this. So I wouldn't be banking on that. Well, but if somebody's got an asset that's easy to sell, that would be who would sell.
The inclusion rate was higher in the 90s.
So what's interesting to me about this was that it was a previous Liberal finance minister, Paul Martin, who lowered the inclusion rate from 66% to 50% in a bid to spur productivity, to spur innovation, to spur growth. And now we have another Liberal finance minister that in the face of a widening productivity gap and slower growth, decided to raise the thing. Like, wait a minute, maybe you should have followed Paul Martin's lead, maybe lowered the thing again instead of raising it. But they've spent so much money, an enormous amount of money. I think the fact that they doubled the size of the debt. And by the way, when people say, well, it was because of the pandemic. No, it was not because of the pandemic. Only about half of the money they spent in the pandemic had anything to do with COVID. The rest of it was a ton of other pet projects, including raising the size of the public sector workforce by over 40%. So only half of the money that they spent in COVID was because of COVID. The rest of it was on other things. But at the end of the day, we now have this huge debt. We have this, how are we going to pay for it? And lowering growth, I would argue, is not the way to do it. That doesn't seem like the right outcome.
Well, we also have a few years ago, I mean, the Liberal governments were making noise about tinkering with how Canadian-controlled private corporations are taxed anyway, right?
Yep. Yep.
And I don't, you know, I mean, I was sort of heavily into it at the time. I don't remember all the details, but what was very, very clear was that they were not actually happy about people using these things as private pension plans.
Well, you're right. So Bill Morneau, the previous finance minister, I would argue he was playing whack-a-mole. You know, this is like the game at the X or the fair. You know, they see something, they want to hit it. And so one of the things he looked around is he said, wait a minute, look at all this money that people are using in these corporations, holding companies and other things to save capital. hang on a minute, there's a lot of money there. Let's go after it. And so one of the ways he did that, and by the way he characterized it at the time, made a lot of business owners angry. It sounded like people that were honestly going about their business now were tax cheats. So the way they described that was unfortunate. And that's one of the reasons I think Bill Murray was not in that job anymore. But one of the things that he did was he placed a what's called a grind on passive income. So if you have a corporation and you have more than $50,000 a year that comes from passive investments, you face a higher tax rate on that. So that's the first thing they did. Now they've said, well, not only that, but if you have any capital gains, you're also going to pay more tax on that too. So I think that's one thing that I think people need to realize is that it's not just one tax change. We've now had this is now a continuum of them that makes it very difficult for people to save for their retirement in those structures because they're making it very tax unfriendly. And we should also explain to people, you know this topic, but there's a concept called integration in our tax code, which is now broken because the concept of integration is supposed to be that as an investor, as an individual, you should be indifferent if you have a dollar that you've earned inside of your corporation or earned it personally. Because by the time your corporation pays tax and you take it out and you pay tax, it should be the same. You should be relatively neutral on that. Now, that isn't always the case, but that's what they're aiming for. Now, with this change, they've completely broken that. And so now it's a disincentive to earn income inside of a corporation. You're far better to earn it personally. And that's a really drastic change to how many, many people have done their planning for a long time.
Well, that's exactly right. And for anybody listening to this who doesn't fully understand this, you may remember from your T5 or whatever that you get, there's a gross up and there's a dividend tax credit. And that's to reflect the fact, okay, that basically the tax code is trying to give you credit for the tax the corporation paid.
Right.
So that it, in theory, at least works out neutrally. But I agree that raising the taxes inside the corporation obviously upsets the apple cart in that respect. And this doesn't even, account for the, what I would call the administrative burden and hassle of running these corporations.
Yeah, so that was on its own a bit of a disincentive to doing it. You had to generate enough business income and surplus income to be worth having the thing, right? So now on top of that additional cost, you've now got more taxation. And it's not just once, it seems to be over and over again. It would have been a bit different, I would argue, had they applied the same $250,000 threshold that they do personally, where, annually you don't face the higher tax rate or higher inclusion rate, I should say, unless you go over $250,000 of income. They could have easily applied that same rule to corporations, which I think would have been a little fairer. That would have been like, well, okay, I get it. But to put it on dollar one that you pay the higher tax rate really seems surprising and a little excessive, I would argue.
What do you think the rationale for that was?
Well, I think going back to what you mentioned, they see all the money sitting there. Let's go get it. And there also seems to be, and again, I might be reading between the lines, but I'm just looking at, kind of the messaging that seems to be coming from the ruling party and their supporter in the NDP, that there's this concept that if you have money, you're rich and we should take it. That may be unfair, but that seems to be the simplistic view of it, right? And everybody's rich, apparently. If you make over $60,000, apparently you're rich in Canada. I think many people would be shocked to hear themselves described as such.
That's right. Well, I mean, this is the problem of having governments composed of people who really are not particularly connected to the problems that most people have in life, right? Trying to make income, pay bills, etc.
Well, look, if you got a job for 6 years and you have a pension worth $1.5 million for the rest of your life, you might not be like my neighbor. That might be a bit of an situation. Right. Yeah. And that's interesting. I think, again, this is not news. This is something that happened fairly recently. They moved the date by which they're going to have the second election because if it was on the current date, the people that got elected last term would not have quite enough days to get their pension. But if they moved the yardstick by... Yeah, if we move the yardstick by like 2 weeks, hey, we all get it. So is it a surprise they voted for that?
No.
Actually, what a shock.
The irrelevance of the individual MP, what I've often said in conversation to people, particularly, those who are considering running as candidates, say, look, why don't you just tell people that you're more deserving of the pension than somebody else?
Well, and you're right. Like the average MP has like no power. It's, we don't have
really zero, absolutely zero
representative population. No, we have a dictatorship
party, right? Yeah. I mean, it's terrible.
That's the system we have. That's, you know, like it or not, that's the system we have. I think the one thing that's surprising our clients, and again, I respect that we see a relatively specific subset of Canadians, people that have, you know, planned and looked after their own affairs. They've done a good job. They've worked hard. They've been diligent. They did all the things that they were taught to do. And this may seem old fashioned, but they were responsible and they looked after themselves and they put capital away and they saved for their future and they thought about it. And they're now being told, hey, you know, you need to pay for people that didn't do that or weren't as good at that. And it's not that people don't think we should pay taxes, that we need to be responsible and good citizens. We do. It's just at some, there is a breaking point where people think the deal is not fair anymore. And I'm increasingly hearing people say, this isn't right. This isn't what we're trying to plan for. And it makes it certainly harder for us to accomplish the goals we have for our families. And they don't see any course, they don't see any end to it. And indeed, if you look at the projections for the federal government's debt and deficit, there's no path, zero path to getting back to breaking even. Like if the federal government was my client, they'd be getting a pretty stern talking to about their spending and they need to go get another job.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because shockingly, John, the budget will not balance itself. I know that comes as a surprise to many people,
particularly
the Prime Minister.
Said it would.
No, he said it would. He said in his first term, the budget will balance itself. He said that. Apparently, it doesn't do that. That might come as a surprise to anyone who's read a textbook. But moving on, I digress. These are my jokes.
That's interesting. I don't recall saying that. I think it's, you know, you give them too much credit, right? I don't think they even care about this one way or the other.
No, I can find the clip when he said, don't worry, the budget will balance itself. He also told another reporter he doesn't spend any time looking at monetary policy. That should not shock you.
Automagically, yeah. So, you know, part of the background of this, it seems to me, or maybe when you get interested in something, you just see more about it in the news and that. But, you know, the fault line, I think, in at least Toronto and other parts of Canada, there seem to be two kinds of people, those who own a house and those who don't.
That is becoming a real demarcation of who's in which category. Very true. Unfortunately, you're right.
And, you know, to some extent, I see this, you know, you look at the $250,000 for individuals, you know, the lower rate. I see this as a way to tax capital gains on real estate, actually.
Oh, I think that's definitely the case. It's certainly the case for second properties, you know, your cottage or if you're a rental, which is also interesting because here they're saying we have a housing crisis and we've got to spur the ability to have homes, to have rentals and everything else. Well, they've certainly made it harder for anybody to do that because I wouldn't be surprised if you see people suddenly putting homes on the market today to try and sell that, you know, if they have two or three rental properties, let's get rid of a couple between now and the end of June to get the lower tax rate. And then what is if they have a tenant in that property, are they in trouble? Are they going to be kicked out? I don't know. So they haven't made it smoother. They've made it more difficult.
You know, that's a different issue. But, you know, where my mind goes from that, right? We start from the principle, you know, leaving aside the specifics of what they're doing here, you know, raising the tax in this way. If the fault line is, you know, those who own a house and those who don't, do you think that there's a reasonable chance they're going to start taxing the gains on the sale of principal?
I have been saying to people for years, I think this is definitely coming. And again, I go back to the point I made at the beginning, which is if you want more of something, lower the tax on it. You want less of something, add the tax on it. So one of the reasons we've seen the housing market in Canada get completely disconnected from reality, right? From incomes, and we've outpaced, you know, every major market in the United States, for example, on affordability levels. Part of that is because that's the only asset in Canada you can own that doesn't have any tax on it when you go to sell it. So there's a reason why people have bought their own homes and maybe bought more home than they should have and over leveraged because it was the only way you had a tax-free asset. So now guess what? We have this huge housing bubble. Is that a surprise? And to me, the indication that they're eventually going to tax principal residences is they made it reportable on your tax return 3 years ago. Like, yeah, why did they do that?
By the way, that was very damaging to a lot of U.S. citizens in Canada, of course, who'd been doing their U.S. taxes by just giving their Canadian tax return to their, you know.
Yeah, suddenly, wait a minute, you have a place where? Yeah.
That's right. So, you know, that's interesting.
But I found it really surprising that they decided to make it a reportable requirement. For if it's not taxable, why are we reporting on our tax returns?
Well,
their argument at the time was, well, they said, look, we want to get the people that are flipping houses and abusing it. It's like, wait a second, there's other ways to do this than require everyone who sold a principal residence, which isn't a taxable event. Now I have to put it on my tax return? This is almost as logical as the unused housing tax thing in Toronto, but we'll talk about that another time. But the fact is they put that on the tax return. And to me, personally, this is not Raymond James' opinion, it's Darren Coleman's opinion. They did that to set up the bureaucracy and the reporting mechanism and all the software and everything else so that one day you're going to have to pay tax on it. Now, I think they'll approach it, if they do this, the same way they've done it with capital gains. They'll give everybody a certain amount of exemption. They'll say, look, on the first $1 million, you don't pay. And I think the average person will say, well, that's terrible, but you know, it doesn't apply to me, so let it go. Well, you've heard the joke about how you boil a frog, right? You don't put a frog in hot water, it jumps out. You put it in, well, it's cool, and then you heat it up. And I think that, unfortunately, if they start inputting any tax on principal residences, even if there's an exemption and people don't think it applies to them, it will eventually. So I think this is on the road to that.
Apply to them on debt. Well, not, I guess not on a principal residence, but the point is simply this, that if they exclude a certain amount, right? So death is a deemed sale. They'll probably have to roll over to a spouse or something, but death is a deemed sale. And if only a certain amount is excluded from capital gains, then even, you know, when people die, they're going to be hit with this. I mean, the whole idea that Canada doesn't have death tax, as we were mentioning
earlier. Oh, yeah, we just don't call it a death tax, right?
Risk.
Yeah, there absolutely is. Anyone who's had to settle an estate for a family member knows that there's a tax bill that comes. There's no getting around that.
Yeah, but back to the approach is, it's just a deemed sale. It's a deemed sale for disposition of everything you own. And
yeah,
that can be a whole pile of different things.
It often surprises people what gets brought into the mix, right? So you're right. If you have any assets, you know, again, the home at the moment is the one that is tax-free, but everything else falls into that, including, for example, your registered plan. So your RSPs and your RIFs, you know, we are allowed to roll those over to a spouse and then they step into your shoes and they get on a tax-free basis, but that's it. After your spouse inherits, anything after when they pass away, all of it is subject to taxation as full income in that year, which is at the highest rate that you would pay tax.
Well, with the inclusion, certainly will be at the highest rate. Well, maybe this is an argument for single people on their deathbed getting a spouse.
Well, that's a whole other bowl. That's a whole other conversation, right? I'm not advocating that people go and, you know, go on Tinder while they're having their last few breaths. That might not be a good idea, but
it is a tax deferral, isn't it?
It is. But I would argue that in the United States, what they've done with IRAs, which would be the equivalent really to an RSP in Canada, is that they've got much better rules on how that can work. Because you can leave it to more than just your spouse. And the person who receives it could be your children, for example. They get a 10-year tax deferral. They still have to take the money out, but they get 10 years over which to do it and have the taxation applied. So much friendlier from that perspective.
Up until a few years ago, it was longer than 10 years.
It was absolutely longer. Yeah, so that's the thing. So they've actually made their system a little more unfriendly, but it's still better than ours.
Yeah.
Right. And this is going to be a real interesting thing as people are living longer, you know, like life expectancy is going up, you know, people are changing spouses. Like there's so much that says people are going to need more money for longer, you know, and for example, this is a good example of how people can think about how things are changing. So John, I want you to think back to when you were a kid, if somebody turned age 100, I would argue two things happened 40 years ago, 50 years ago, the local news channel showed up to film them and they got a letter from the Queen. Those two things, because it was so unusual. If you go to your local Shoppers Drug Mart right now, or any drugstore, go to the birthday card section, I will bet you there's at least three birthday cards that say happy 100th. So what used to be rare is now fairly norm. And it's just going up how frequently this happens.
Which is
definitely living longer. And again, if we don't give people the ability to plan their own futures and their own financial responsibility, who's going to pay for it?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, it's very, very clear. I mean, if you know, you compare, for example, the U.S. IRA to whatever the RRSP, I would argue that U.S. Social Security benefits are a lot better.
Oh, much healthier than we have in Canada. Yeah. Wow. Absolutely. And then you get into the, like, how long is old age security, for example, you know, you can collect that, but then it starts to get taken away from you at a certain income level. Those things, it's really difficult to say that they're going to stay where they are. If you're 40 or 50 or 60 years old today, it's hard to forecast that the benefits we see today will be what they are when you get there. It's very unlikely. There's just too many people that are going to be taking from it for it to stay as it is. And interestingly, a previous government had thought about moving the retirement age for Canada Pension from 65 to 67. And that was to maintain the health of the plan as people got older and lived longer. Well, the current government, when they came in, they rolled that back because it was more popular to leave it at 65. But you talk to any actuary, they're like, that was a mistake. We're going to regret that decision.
But it's clearly a mistake, you know, given the fact that people are living, it's clearly a mistake.
Well, when CPP was created, you know, you retired at 65, but you were dead by 72.
Yeah.
You know, I have people that are in their 70s now, they're buying kayaks, not for their grandchildren, but for themselves. And they're on Peloton. Like some of these people, I'm like, are we going to die? They're in such good shape, right? And I would say, just look around. Remember what a 75-year-old looked like when you were a kid? They were old. Look at somebody 75 today. They're having a great time. They're not old anymore. They're not old in the way we thought that old was going to look. And this just keeps on changing. So so my perspective is, and maybe it's because of what I do for a living, we help people to be able to not just get to having a comfortable retirement, but then staying comfortably retired. And anything that impacts that, especially government reducing or adding more friction to your pursuit of being financially independent is a problem, because you're now going to have more people beholden to government, I guess. Maybe that's the long-term plan. I'm not sure. That kind of smells like socialism, but that may be where we're headed.
Well, the history of the last 100 years has been government replacing church, community, and family, right, as the primary support system.
Right.
That's very, very clear. And that's very, very bad. Because
it's an interesting perspective, because you know we're not in a Dickinson world anymore, where people had to go and, you know, work at the mill and have lousy living conditions. It's good we changed a lot of those things, and we rightfully ought to have more support systems. I would just say, like, at some point there needs to be a threshold over, like, hang on, maybe we're doing too much. And my argument personally is, I think government has to walk a tightrope, a really fine line between doing as much as necessary and as little as possible. Because no one has repealed the law of unintended consequences.
Sort of like Warren Buffett when asked how much money he leave to his children. Well, you know, I leave them enough so they could do anything, but not so much they couldn't do anything.
Right. Right.
And I'm not sure where we are in the continuum, but my general sense is that people are far, far too reliant on government, you know, on their minds to sort of, you know, take care of themselves.
Well, and the messaging that we've been seeing is certainly like, hey, we'll solve your problems. But I think people need to be reminded of something Ronald Reagan said a long time ago, which he said the 9 most dangerous words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Actually, well, that was an important thing he said. Second important thing, or another one, was freedom is one generation away from extinction.
Very true.
And, you know, the more government we have, you know, necessarily. I mean, it's practically a tautology, right? I mean, the less freedom you have. And the less freedom you have, the more personal responsibility is disincentivized. So, you know, this is not good. I mean, the problem with Canada, at least the way I sort of perceive it, sitting here in Canada, is that, you know, the tax situation is so bad that I can never tell whether I'm making money or not.
Well, certainly when you get your tax bill, you're like, ooh, that really stings. And it's never going down. It never seems to go the other direction. So you've got to decide, do you want to work harder and try to get a little bit ahead of that wind in your face? Or you just give up and go, well, what's the point? And that's something that worries me, because when the average person says, wait a second, I'm at, when I take my income taxes, my GST, the tax on, like, user fees, like, I'm waiting for a tip option on your tax return. I'm waiting for that to show up, right? But when they look at it and say, wait a minute, what's the point of working a little harder when most of that extra effort just is taxed away? Like, why am I going to spend and take extra risk and everything else to earn another dollar when I only get maybe 30 or 40 cents of that? That seems to be like an unfair exchange. And so that reduces productivity, that reduces wealth in a country. We should be finding ways to incent people to go and work harder and do more and deliver more and innovate. Things that take away from that ultimately make us poorer.
Well, the only people who are going to do that are people who don't consider themselves to be working at all. I mean, you know, the problem is where you have people who don't, you know, who would rather do things other than work. And, you know, high tax rates are particularly hard on that particular group.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think, where do you think this is going to go? What's your sense of the proportion of people who will elect to realize gains now? I mean, I understand the government is projecting a huge capital gain increase.
You're right. They're definitely counting on it. That's why I think the reason why they didn't have it active as the day of the budget. Normally, that's what happens. As soon as the finance minister stands up, that's the effective date of the changes. They've moved it out, which I actually figured they would. I thought for the last few years they would change the inclusion rate, and I figured they would give people time because they want to get that windfall of people rushing to get their transactions done. It's hard to sell a property in 5 weeks, but a little easier in your investment accounts to just hit a button and sell them.
Large unrealized gains in stock portfolios, particularly, if they're U.S. securities, given the favorable exchange rate if you're selling.
Yeah, they've had an appreciation of the asset and they've had a currency gain. Yeah, additionally, right. They have to report. Yeah, yes.
That might be, I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but if you add in the exchange rate benefit of selling now, would you think that's a reasonable thing to do?
Well, this is the point, right? And so we're having those conversations with our clients that are facing that at the moment and saying, what should we do? Let's run some math. And if you decide, because one of the benefits of capital gains is this concept of deferral. You don't pay any tax until you sell the asset. So I think right now the break even is something like 8 or 9 years. So even if you pay the higher tax rate, but if you've deferred it for another 8 or 9 years, that probably is worth it compared to selling it now. But everybody's got to run their own math. And as you mentioned earlier, it comes to their personal circumstance in terms of, do you want to pay more now? And as I say, if the finance minister is assuming a $4.9 billion windfall from people racing out to do this, we'll see if she's close to her estimate.
Going to be dying soon, probably should do that.
Well, we do have, as medical assistance in dying legalized now? I'm not sure if you can just call your buddy up or... I'm not sure how that works exactly. I haven't looked into it too much, but you're right. Yeah, if you were going to die, you might want to pick, early June would be great. July 1st, bad idea.
I think that's exactly right. But going back to the whole circumstance of dying for a minute.
Yeah.
So you got all these clients and you're helping them plan their finances. What are your views on the possibility of early estate planning in the form of simply gifting and, well, of course, the deemed disposition, right? But gifting assets to children and that before they appreciate further.
Well, so yeah, this concept of an estate freeze. Again, that's one that people might say, look, at least I can crystallize the gain. And then it can be, if I can push it off, again, deferral being the key element of that. If I can place the asset in the hands of my children and, whether it's my shares of my business or stocks that I think I'm going to hold for a long, long time or the cottage or something like that. If we really think that asset, we want to stay in the family for decades, maybe I should put that in the hands of a younger generation to avoid that deemed disposition. All of these are valid conversations.
Before June 25th.
Well, this is just, so I want to see if I get that transaction done now, pay the tax and then give it to somebody else. So these are all things that people, so we're all in a bit of a scramble now going, who's affected by this and what should those conversations be? Because if you just ignore it, put your head in the sand and say, well, I'll pay attention to this later. Well, you may have missed a chance to get out at the current tax rate. Right. But again, it really depends on where they hold the asset and what's the value of that asset. If they hold it personally and they've got a reasonable size portfolio, it might be possible that you realize less than $250,000 a year in gains and then these changes don't really apply to you. But you're right. It's those big ticket things like cottages and properties that are going to capture people that don't think they're wealthy. And again, they may have had these things for a long, long time and are shocked to discover that I've got to pay what? This rate on this? That seems...
Well, let me give you a simple statement. I'd be interested in getting your views on it. So, family cottage, wanting it to stay in family, significant gains. You're going to leave it to your children. Does it make sense to transfer it out today?
So, if you want to pay the tax bill today, maybe it does. You're going to have to go through land transfer tax. You're going to have to get a lawyer involved. This is the problem. It's a really tough thing to do, even if you wanted to do it, to get it done by that. Yeah. That's hard. There are other solutions to look at. Part of it might be, look, let's just go buy life insurance to pay the tax bill. That might wind up being the most economical way to do it. It's certainly one of the cleanest. If you have reasonable health, just go get a life insurance policy and maybe have your kids pay for it. So if your kids are going to receive the cottage, maybe they pay the premiums. That might not be a bad trade. We've seen clients do that. So, mom or dad get a life insurance policy on what they think we forecast the tax liability is going to be. Obviously, it's going to be a higher tax bill than we thought today, but maybe we just buy life insurance to cover it. So, you know, that way the kids get the prizes and we have the cash to pay CRA. That's a relatively straightforward solution to that problem that doesn't involve lawyers and re-registering things and everything else. But you have to qualify for it and someone's going to have to pay the premium. But that could be the cheapest solution. It's certainly the most easy to implement.
So we've been talking around this whole death thing, and it occurs to me that nobody has explained clearly what happens when somebody dies. So why don't I invite you to do that? Why is this a tax problem? And why is there a significant...
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me about things like reincarnation. Look, I said in 1875, I didn't believe in reincarnation. I say the same today, right?
After we get past June 25th.
Sorry, I went off on my own tangent there. So what was your question?
Maybe just explain clearly for listeners exactly what happens from a tax perspective when Canada dies.
Yeah, so what the Canadian government and CRA assumes is that you sold everything about 2 minutes before you took your last breath. So on the day before you died, you sold everything. So you then have to go through an exercise of saying, well, what was the value on, you know, the day before I died? And then what was my cost of that asset when I have it? So you, number one, keep good records of what did you buy the cottage for or the real estate property for. If you have an investment portfolio, your advisor or your broker should have all those records. Make sure your family knows where those things are. And then did you put any improvements into it that may have raised your cost base? So if you had a rental unit or apartment building or whatever, what did you do to maybe increase the capital value of that? Some of those, and your accountant can take you through what those items would be. But there is a recognition, a reckoning of, well, what is your capital gain on death? So that's what we don't call it a death tax, but that's effectively what it is.
In other words, it's as though you really did sell it all.
Exactly. So the day before you died, you sold everything, crystallized it, and now you got to pay the tax bill accordingly. And some assets may have gone to somebody else, but generally you're on the hook for that, or your estate is.
How come everybody in Canada thinks there's no death tax?
Well, I think because we live next to the United States and we get all their media, when we hear about inheritance taxes and other things, that's a very American issue. There's a very specific dollar amount and way it's applied. In Canada, we just have this deemed disposition concept, which results in taxation. We just don't call it a wealth tax. We don't have things like gift taxes and other things. So we have two different systems. We are two different countries. That sometimes surprises people. But we don't have a wealth tax by name, but we certainly have one in reality.
And of course, in the United States, the estate tax doesn't apply till you hit, what's currently about $12 million,
but right,
going down. But the point is that although everybody in Canada has a death tax, only some people in the United States have a death tax.
That's right.
Agree with
that's
it?
Exactly right. Yes, exactly right. And I'd say that, the U.S., their tax policy, now you can have lots of conversations about good things versus bad things in the U.S., but their tax policy is a little more aligned to where population has money, right? So like their highest tax brackets don't kick in until a very high income amount. You know, they can file as married, they can merge their tax returns together. So things like income splitting are automatic in the United States. In Canada, it's really hard to do. So there's a lot of differences, but I would argue that in Canada, you hit the higher tax rates at a vastly lower level of income and wealth than you do in the United States. And then when you look at things like living standards, productivity things, it's much better in the US than Canada. It's very unfortunate, but I'm a capitalist. As a Canadian, this is not a good patriotic argument. It's kind of sad.
Well, we're not talking about patriotism. We're talking about taxation at the moment.
Right.
I mean, there are many people who love high taxes in Canada.
They can pay mine. I'd be happy to have them have more joy if they wish.
But, so you've got all these clients who are, dual citizens or what have you. They're calling you up and saying, I'm thinking of moving to the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've had a number of those conversations just in the last week.
Last week? Who could have known?
Just in the last week. Well, because what caused that? Yeah. Wonder what caused that? What the straw camel? That's what, yeah.
How are you having that conversation with?
Well, I think the first thing is to make them aware of what the process looks like. So it's not to say do it or don't do it. Say, let's just have, a little more fulsome conversation about what does it look like in Canada? Because in the United States, if because the U.S. taxes on citizenship, Canada taxes on residency. So two very, very different systems. So if somebody's an American citizen, they pay tax no matter where they live, period. Now, if they want to escape that tax regime, there's a very defined process, as you know, for someone to renounce their U.S. citizenship. And it can be very costly, but it's a very prescribed process. Canada, not so much. You know, because we're taxed on residency, you have to demonstrate that you've severed your residential ties to Canada. So you got to make it look like I don't live here anymore. So it's not that there's any one thing. There's like a collection of things. And you're kind of measured on, well, how close did you get to that? So it's not you do one or two things and you do it. It's like, well, I have to do a bunch of stuff. And that's where they got to go to a consultant like you and say, did I actually do it or didn't do it? It's a fact pattern. And it's not one fact pattern. It's your fact pattern. So it becomes a little trickier to say, did I sever all those ties? Did I untangle myself sufficiently? And it's things like, do I still have a residence here I can visit all the time? Did I keep my driver's license? Did I keep my golf club membership? If you've kept all that stuff, they're going to say you didn't go anywhere. You didn't leave. You're still here. So you have to make it look like you're going and not coming back. It's a little harder to figure it out because, as I say, it's really an assessment of your fact pattern. And that's where, honestly, anyone that's looking or considering that really has to avail themselves of really good advice to make sure they followed that, those precedents and everything correctly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, Canada is not known for letting people go easily.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think? You know, I mean, things were bad, right? From a tax point of view, but these types of things, I think, really function more to remind people how bad they are.
Well, it's been interesting to me to see the degree to which, you know, different disparate groups have come together all angry about this. That's been interesting. So I don't know if it'll make a change, if the finance minister will change your view on it or not, but it's certainly interesting to the degree to which the volume of complaints has gone up from lots of different places. And I think also it's drawn attention to just what kind of fiscal trouble are we in? And, you know, there's, as I said, there's no path to paying the bills. There's no path back to a balanced budget. It's just not there. So the degree to which, and again, the Liberals were on a very good campaign the last few months with announcements about all the spending that they're doing. Well, that's got a bill attached to it. And now that it's coming due, it's a hard thing to justify, in my view.
So,
but maybe this is the end of it. I don't know. Maybe people are finally so fed up, they'll vote differently.
Next year, I think we've got an election. Do you think the Liberal government will live another day?
Well, they're still very popular with some people. And look, there's a long time between now and lots of crazy things can happen, right? I think the first thing we got to go through is this circus act of the United States election first. That's going to be just total chaos. So we'll get through that.
What are your thoughts
on that one? I am shocked that those are the candidates that our American cousins have to pick from. What on earth is that? I'm at the point now where I'm really just hoping we just get whoever wins should be really good for Saturday Night Live. Let's just go with the comedy element of it because there's, from a policy perspective, I don't know. None of this makes any sense. A friend of mine a few years ago made a comment, and I think you'll agree with this because it's stuck in my brain. He said, hey, Darren, do you get the sense that the world's being run by amateurs now? And I can't shake that thought. I cannot shake that thought because every time I look around, I'm like, that's validated pretty much everywhere. So I don't know what's going to happen in the U.S. I think it's
being run by amateurs whose general worldview has nothing to do with the 21st century.
Well, that's a deeper conversation. But I unfortunately think a lot of people are getting into power that have an angle that is not about being a good steward and a good administrator. I think there's too much flash and we're in this Instagram, Snapchat world where people just want to get popular and get clicks and votes and likes. I would really like, and this is in either country, a really quiet administrator that comes in and says, I'm not here to change the world. I'm just going to make sure this works really well. That would be awesome. But they won't get elected because competency doesn't seem to matter anymore.
No, actually, well, it matters. I think it's seen as a bad thing.
maybe that's what it is. Yeah, if you're good at this, we don't trust you.
They're looking for entertainment or whatever. All right. Well, you know.
Well, you know, there's that old line about how we get the government we deserve. So let's reflect on that. So what are we asking for? What are we looking for?
Are we really that bad in Canada now?
Well, I think we'll see what happens in the next election whenever we get one, right? We're kind of held hostage right now as a nation to a deal that two political parties that are supposed to be fighting with each other have decided to be corresponding together, which is like, well, what's the point of that? But it is what it is. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see. But it's a long time between now and the next election. Lots of wacky stuff can happen. If it was election tomorrow, I think it would go a certain way, but we're a long way from that.
I wouldn't be able to call an election tomorrow. Actually, I think that the, in the urban areas of Canada, I think the support for the Liberals is much, much stronger than.
And it could be. Unfortunately, what you and I see are people that they just vote with their feet and with their wallet.
Well, that's right.
But where do they go, right? Like when we run portfolios, we have such a low weighting to Canada now because there's just way more to buy wonderful businesses and with a healthier environment to operate in the United States than Canada. That's unfortunate, but that's what we see. And again, I'm a capitalist. We work with people that have mobility. They can go and work on other places. So they're doing that. And it's not just the United States, it's around the world. So, the average person will decide what's best for them and take action accordingly. And, I'm afraid that we may wind up with a situation that the people that can and ought to pay the bills are choosing that we're just going to go where our capital is more welcome. And that's this, and this is what really concerns me, is this idea that there's been the tonality, that the language being used about some of this stuff is kind of pitting one class against another, which is not how it ought to work.
It's definitely class warfare.
Yeah. And that's really not going to work out well for people. Yeah.
Well, this is all around the world, though. I mean, you look at what's happening in social media. I mean, there's this, constant drumbeat about, the tax evasion. I mean, honestly, I don't know about you, but I've met very few people, if any, in my life, who are evading taxes.
No, I don't know any criminals, but I certainly meet people that say, look, I've worked really hard. I'd like to keep more of what I did. That would be nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would be nice. So hopefully, the next wave of change will be a little bit more of a recognition that if you worked hard, you get to enjoy more of the fruits of your labor, right? And you just get to spend accordingly and treat you as responsible. But I might be dreaming.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a while before the pendulum swings back there. Anyway, this has been great.
But it does swing. That's the good news. The pendulum does swing. So we'll see what comes back.
Not very fast. Great conversation. Why don't you remind people of what you do and how to get in touch with you and all that
stuff? For sure. Yeah. So we've got two websites. So we have ColemanWealth.com, which is kind of our domestic website for Canadians. And then our cross-border dedicated website is PortageWealth.com. And I'm based in Oakville, Ontario, but with the internet, we can be anywhere.
And you're part of the Raymond James Group, correct?
Yeah, so we're part of the Raymond. I don't know where you get the Tampa Bay Buccaneers tickets. Sometimes people ask us because the Tampa Bay Buccaneers play in Raymond James Stadium in Tampa, but I don't know where the tickets are. No one tells me.
Okay. All right. Well, that's great. Well, thanks very much, and look forward to connecting with you again.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it. And for the listeners, thank you for listening to us. I'm thankful for the time together.
Good conversation.